This is Free Speech Radio News for Wednesday, March 21st, 2007. From KPFA in Berkeley, this is Aaron Glantz sitting in for Aldo Bogado. House Democrats gear up for what could be a battle between Congress and the White House over the firing of 8 U.S. attorneys. In Iraq, a new U.S. military strategy to secure Sadr City sparks outrage for local residents. And we'll hear why some say Halliburton's plans to relocate to Dubai is a move towards shifting world trade policy. Those stories and more after the headlines.
I'm Shannon Young with today's headlines. Fierce fighting has erupted in Somalia after government troops tried to search for weapons in one of Mogadishu's neighborhoods. Abdulrahman Warsame reports.
At least 17 people were killed and more than 100 civilians were wounded as heavy fighting broke out this morning between unidentified assailants and Somali government troops backed by Ethiopian soldiers around the Shirkar neighborhood and the former defense minister building where the Ethiopians are based in the south of Somali capital Mogadishu. A total of 7 soldiers were killed. 2 dead soldiers who were dragged in the streets of the capital by angry mobs are thought to be Ethiopians, but this can be difficult to determine as both Ethiopian soldiers and Somali government troops wear same uniform. The sound of heavy artillery and small gunfire could be heard throughout the capital. The fighting has died down as night fall, but is likely to resume at daytime tomorrow. There has been an upsurge of sporadic attacks in Somalia, particularly the capital, Mogadishu, since the Ethiopian-backed government forced Islamists from power in December. The government has blamed remnants of the defeated Islamist movement who are in Mogadishu under clan protection for the almost daily attacks. For FSRN, this is Abdulrahman Warsame in Mogadishu.
Ecuador's parliament was on its feet again today after 54 of 57 members recently fired for blocking a referendum on a new constituent assembly were replaced. FSRN's Quito correspondent Joseph Muti has more.
Ecuador's Supreme Electoral Council effectively shut down the nation's parliament on March the 7th by removing 57 of its 100 members for deliberately blocking a referendum scheduled by recently elected President Rafael Correa. The referendum on whether or not the people of Ecuador want a nonpartisan-based constituent assembly was originally scheduled for March the 18th, but had to be delayed by a month after the 57 deputies made a parliamentary vote approving the referendum impossible. They were subsequently removed for interfering with Ecuador's political process for partisan reasons and censured by the remaining members of parliament. There were clashes outside parliament as the fired legislators and their supporters attempted to enter parliament yesterday when 21 of the 54 deputies were sworn in. Correa has a 70% approval rating in the nation and has vowed from the outset that he would rid his country of the destructive party politics that had turned parliament into what he coined a sewer of corruption. President Correa is seen as having gained an important victory in this confrontation with the nation's legislature, and its political future is now generally agreed to be far more sound after the last 2 weeks of crisis. He had previously threatened to resign if he was unable to carry out his electoral promises. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Joseph Muti.
Colombia's Attorney General has announced he will make extradition requests to the U.S. for 8 employees of Chiquita Brands International. The banana company has already pleaded guilty in U.S. federal court to having paid some $1.7 million to the United Self-Defense Forces of Colombia. The right-wing paramilitary group is on the U.S. government's list of terrorist organizations. Chiquita says it made the payments in order to protect its operations in Colombia. Both paramilitary organizations and guerrilla groups extort money from agricultural operations in rural Colombia by demanding protection money. The United Self-Defense Forces of Colombia, or AUC as it's known by its Spanish acronym, has been implicated in the deaths of several union organizers and is responsible for some of the worst massacres in the history of Colombia's civil war. The UK's Defense Secretary Des Brown has ordered a partial ban on cluster bombs. The decision follows advice from government officials and human rights campaigners. Manuel Rueda reports from London.
Cluster bombs can be dropped by air or fired from the ground. They can disperse their smaller bomblets over an area as large as 4 football fields. Bomblets that fail to explode upon impact often become de facto landmines. Starting today, the British Armed Forces will only hang on to so-called smart cluster bombs. In other words, those bombs that have self-destructing mechanisms. Thomas Nash coordinates the Cluster Munition Coalition. He welcomes the new policy, but says that it doesn't go far enough.
The Cluster Munition Coalition is saying very clearly that we need to ban the self-destruct cluster munitions as well as all the other cluster munitions. If you walk through the fields of southern Lebanon, you will see that there's nothing about a self-destruct mechanism that makes a bomb smart.
The Cluster Munition Coalition says cluster bombs threaten lives long after conflicts are over. Norway is currently leading efforts to create an international ban on cluster bombs by next year. Over 45 countries have signed an initial declaration, but so far, the U.S. and Israel have not shown any interest. This is Manuel Rueda, reporting from London for Free Speech Radio News.
The House of Representatives today passed the Gulf Coast Hurricane Housing Recovery Act by a vote of 302 to 125. The measure frees up federal money specifically aimed at easing the housing crisis in areas devastated by Hurricanes Katrina and Rita. Those are today's headlines. I'm Shannon Young for Free Speech Radio News.
House Democrats have set up the stage for what could become a battle between Congress and the White House. Democrats voted to allow subpoenas of administration officials and administration documents pertaining to the firing of 8 U.S. attorneys, who Democrats say were terminated because they would not use their positions for partisan political objectives. The White House originally refuted any direct link to dismissing the attorneys, but thousands of emails released by the Department of Justice appear to link Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez and former White House Chief Counsel Harriet Myers to the firings. Now the House wants sworn testimony from top White House aides. Chair of a House Judiciary Subcommittee, Linda Sanchez.
However, the administration and Justice Department have not been as cooperative in our investigation as we had hoped.
Chair of the House Judiciary Committee John Conyers said he would not issue any subpoenas until negotiations with the White House are complete, but the president gave his final offer. In a last-minute press conference, Bush said he will provide Congress the testimony of Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez and his staff and access to more than 3,000 pages of Department of Justice documents recently released, and an unscripted, closed-door meeting with key administration staff, including political strategist Karl Rove and former White House counsel Harriet Myers.
I have proposed a reasonable way to avoid an impasse. I hope they don't choose confrontation. I will oppose any attempts to subpoena White House officials.
That's an unacceptable proposal to House Democrats, who say the documents have too much redacted information and have not received additional documents from the White House. Chairman Conyers.
I mean, obviously, anyone that comes before the committee would have to be put under oath. Obviously, there would have to be a transcript. We don't do anything without a record.
The president pledged to take the matter to court. Democratic leaders are still trying to shore up enough votes to pass the war supplemental before the full House tomorrow. As Leanne Caldwell reports from Washington, rank-and-file Democrats are struggling with how they'll vote on the $100 billion war funding proposal.
Democratic leaders in the House are optimistic, even though they don't have the 218 votes to pass the war supplemental. Democratic leader Steny Hoyer.
Tomorrow, this Congress, for the first time in 4 years, will have the opportunity to change America's course in Iraq.
The House will take up the $120 billion supplemental bill Thursday. Most of the money goes to fund the war in Iraq, but attached to it are a series of benchmarks for the Iraqi government and a suggested timeline for the U.S. troops to withdraw by September of 2008. And some members are still undecided. Representative Jim McDermott, a liberal Democrat from Seattle, voted against most of the Iraq war supplemental since the war began. As for this one, he's still unsure.
This is not not like a bill in the Congress on how much money to spend dredging the Sacramento River, or how much, what should we do to the banking system because they've had bad loans recently. I mean, it's not that kind of bill. This is about life and death. It's the hardest vote a congressperson makes, sending somebody to die for us.
McDermott fears a supplemental that would give the president a blank check.
This president isn't going to pay any attention to us anyway. I'm in many ways almost resigned to the fact we're going to have war till he's out of office.
McDermott is one of many Democrats who have opposed past supplementals who are either undecided or who will likely vote yes. Representative Xavier Becerra speaking for the Hispanic caucus.
There are many men and women who are in uniform today who are like Jose Gutierrez, and they are perishing right now. And that's why we stand to a person in the Congressional Hispanic Caucus supporting this supplemental appropriations.
Veteran Liberal Democrat Representative Lynn Woolsey is leading the opposition. She's hoping to garner enough votes to defeat the bill. She says that the pressure the new members feel to follow the wishes of their leadership can be overwhelming.
There's so much pressure on new members. My heart breaks for them.
So emotional, freshman member Keith Ellison of Minnesota would not tell the press what his vote will be. And of a dozen members of the Progressive or Out of Iraq caucus on the Appropriations Committee, only one voted against it, a sign that a plum committee assignment could have come into play, as well as funding to help a district, such as a bailout for California spinach farmers, or funding for base realignment. Representative Sylvester Reyes of Texas.
Remember, under the BRAC, we were going to close not only Walter Reed, but Wilford Hall in San Antonio. That allows resources to go back there and rebuild some of those medical centers that are essential.
Nearly $30 billion of non-war funding was added to the supplemental. But Representative McDermott says buying votes isn't that simple when it comes to matters such as war.
I'm not interested in bridges or buildings at my university or, I mean, you know, all the things that people seem, like spinach farmers get some relief or whatever. None of that stuff is, that's not enticing at all.
Meanwhile, Representative Woolsey and other progressives hope an amendment will be added to the supplemental that says funds can only be used to bring the troops home. The liberal group MoveOn.org is lobbying against Woolsey, asking her to stop her fight against the supplemental and take the middle road. She refuses.
The Senate's not going to do what we're doing, so that it will go nowhere. And if the Senate did, the president will veto it. So where we're doing all of this, guess what? Our kids are dying over there. And I just think if we're going to do things that are symbolic, they ought to be real bold and tell the president and the country what we really want to have happen.
The floor debate is expected to begin tomorrow. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leanne Caldwell.
4 years into the war, the U.S. military is trying a new strategy to secure the violent Iraqi capital. But for many Iraqis, it's too little, too late. This is especially true in Sadr City, a part of the capital U.S. troops have mostly avoided since fighting ended between the military and the Mehdi Army, a Shiite militia controlled by Muqtada Sadr. Hiba Daoud files this report.
The strategy is similar to the initial strategy after the invasion 4 years ago. U.S. troops, rather than being stationed solely in large bases, will be deployed to small bases in groups of about 100. About 100 of the small forward operating bases are currently being set up. But for residents of Sadr City, who for the last 3 years have relied on the militia rather than the U.S. military to protect them, the plan has sparked outrage. On Friday, tens of thousands demonstrated against the deployment. During the course of the previous week, U.S. troops had shot up a car, killing at least 3 unarmed civilians from the same family, and failed to prevent an attack by Sunni guerrillas against the mayor of the district, which is the largest and one of the poorest in Baghdad. Fattah al-Sheikh is a member of the Iraqi parliament who lives in Sadr City. Like many, he is unhappy with the apparent reversal of a tacit agreement struck between the U.S. and militia leaders that the military would stay out of Sadr City.
It will create a danger on the American forces and the people of Sadr City. Also, since there is an intense relationship between America and Iran, we don't want to take the responsibility if an attack against the American happens from another side. Maybe the Iranians. Who will give their blood then? Of course, the people of Sadr City. Because then they will be accused of that. We don't want to be in the middle and face attacks from both sides, the American forces and the Iranians. Add to that that Sadr City is a very crowded city. They will be annoyed if they will see American vehicles around when they have no services at all.
Hamdallah Rakabi is a spokesman for the Sadr office in Shala, another large Shia neighborhood whose borders have become battle zones, and fighting goes on between Jaish al-Mahdi and Sunni militiamen nearby.
The goal behind setting up those bases is not to preserve security in Sadr city, but it is to insecure it. They should better think to build it somewhere else. No one wants them to be there. Officials who work at the municipality of Sadr city and the people of Sadr city refused this idea. That should be taken in consideration. Why do Americans always want to impose their agenda?
The tentative ceasefire between the militia and the U.S. military that has been fragile for mostly observed during the last 3 years may falter as the U.S. steps up its efforts to detain members of the militia it suspects has engaged in death squad operations against Sunni civilians. U.S. troops exchanged fire with militiamen on Monday during raids on a pair of mosques believed to be hosting Jaish al-Mahdi fighters, killing three. I am Hiba Dawood for FSRN.
Former Vice President Al Gore returned to Capitol Hill today, urging lawmakers to take action to fight global warming. He spoke before committees in both the House and Senate. His first stop was the House Energy and Air Quality Subcommittee.
I say this to each of you as individuals. I promise you, a day will come when our children and grandchildren will look back. And they'll ask one of two questions. Either they will ask, what in God's name were they doing? Didn't they see the evidence? Didn't they realize that four times in 15 years, the entire scientific community of this world issued unanimous reports calling upon them to act? What was wrong with them?
Gore called for legislation to raise fuel efficiency standards for vehicles, ban incandescent light bulbs, and enact a moratorium on the construction of coal-fired power plants. Gore also supported legislation that would allow homeowners and small businesses to sell unlimited amounts of solar and wind-generated electricity back to the grid at fair prices.
We ought to have a law that allows homeowners and small business people to put up photovoltaic generators and small windmills and any other new sources of widely distributed generation that they can come up with, and allow them to sell that electricity into the grid without any artificial caps.
A NASA Climate Watch scientist is alleging the White House has been tampering with his scientific reports and censoring his speech. He testified before the House Government Reform Committee yesterday. Yunmei She has the story from Capitol Hill.
James Hansen is the top NASA scientist on climate studies. Before answering questions from members of the House panel, he posed his own query.
When I testify to you as a government scientist, why does my testimony have to be reviewed, edited, and changed by a bureaucrat in the White House before I can deliver it?
California Republican Daryl Issa responded.
So your employer is sending you, and your employer happens to be the American taxpayer, but they're sending you at government expense to these speaking engagements.
That's exactly the point.
Well, Dr. Hansen,
I should be able, for the sake of the taxpayers, they should be availed of my expertise.
Hansen says White House regularly edits NASA scientific press releases. Philip Cooney was in charge of the Council on Environmental Quality in the Bush White House 2 years ago. During the hearing, Committee Chairman California Democrat Henry Waxman questioned Cooney over edits he made to federal scientific reports.
Where the draft report said that the climate change would damage the environment, you inserted the qualifier potentially. Where the report described adverse economic effects, you modified the text to say that the economic effects could be positive or negative.
The comments that you describe, and really these were recommendations on federal reports, they weren't hard edits. They were offered within the context of an interagency review process with a lot of people providing recommendations.
Dr. Hansen says the administration's interference with science reveals a deeper problem.
The growth in political interference coincides with a growth in power of the executive branch. It seems to me that this growth of power violates principles upon which our democracy is based, especially separation of powers and checks and balances.
Hansen also says NASA public affairs officers appointed by the administration have been limiting his chances to speak with the media. For Free Speech Radio News, Ye Meixie in Washington, D.C.
Energy services giant Halliburton recently announced it is relocating its corporate offices to Dubai in the United Arab Emirates. The move is part of a global shift away from U.S. dominance of the energy market and towards state-owned oil companies in the Eastern Hemisphere. But as Renee Feltz reports, companies like Halliburton are working to shape world trade policy in this region. The result could be a downturn in use of state oil company profits for social good in order to maximize profit.
Halliburton executives say their move to Dubai won't result in any layoffs at their old headquarters in Houston. Local officials say they won't fight the move. Anti-war activists here weren't surprised.
I think it's pretty telling that they would continue to sort of run from the public scrutiny that has built up as a result of all the allegations of misuse and fraud and overuse of taxpayer money.
Katie Heim of the Houston Global Awareness Collective helped organize anti-war profiteer protest against Halliburton for the past 3 years. Most of the group's scrutiny was directed at the company's subsidiary, KBR, which deals with military contracting in Iraq. Halliburton says it plans to spin off KBR, leaving it to focus on oil industry support. As for avoiding scrutiny in Dubai,
if the company is found to be liable for problems or guilty of fraud, it may be harder to extradite them from the United Arab Emirates. But that's in the past. I really think this is about the future of the oil business.
CorpWatch director Pratap Chatterjee says the future of the oil business is in the Middle East and Africa.
Because they're moving to Dubai, they're going to have more work because they're going to be the place to cut the deals.
Demand for Halliburton's oil field services has declined in North America. But oil drilling is booming in the Middle East, Africa, and South America, where state-owned oil companies control 77% of the total known global oil reserves. Chatterjee says many of these companies benefited from an influx of cash from the U.S. war on terror.
All our money that we spent on buying gasoline in the last 5 years, the doubling of the prices, has gone to Kuwait and Dubai and Saudi Arabia and Iran and Venezuela. You know, all the money we spent in the war has ended up in the economies of Kuwait and Dubai.
Greater demand and higher prices for oil and gas have also led to increased interest by these companies in Halliburton's services. Kenneth Medlock, energy fellow at the James Baker Institute in Houston, helped author a new report on how Western companies need to make the new energy providers focus on efficiency.
Let's say I'm a customer and I'm looking to buy oil or gas or contract oil or gas from a potential provider. I'm likely going to go to the provider that I think will be most likely to deliver on a promise.
The customer in this example is Halliburton, but providers don't always make efficiency their top priority.
There may be very good reasons, very rational reasons, why the firm doesn't necessarily produce as much, and those reasons could be because some of the revenues from production are used rather than for reinvestment in the resource, but, you know, to build schools and hospitals and roads and take care of public infrastructure.
To allow more input from foreign companies on issues like efficiency, Halliburton is working through the World Trade Organization to shape state-owned policy. In 1999, it founded the WTO's Energy Services Coalition. More recently, former Halliburton CEO and current U.S. Vice President Dick Cheney cited the WTO in his National Energy Policy document. He called the WTO the primary vehicle for advancing free trade policy in the energy services industry and reducing non-commercial obligations that can hurt efficiency.
You know, taking the revenues and using them or channeling them back into the general public for the societal good, that sounds very good, right, in the short run, but there's a problem with that in the long run, in that the energy business is a business in which you have to reinvest. And if you're thinking about things from the standpoint of trade policy, yeah, the firms that actually have active reinvestment policies and are trying to grow their businesses to meet demand, those are the ones that will be favored.
Favored by companies like Halliburton. From Houston, I'm Renee Feltz for Free Speech Radio News.
The troubled Indonesian province of West Papua was granted special autonomy status in 2001, which in theory allows Papuans a degree of self-rule. 6 years on, a report released by the Baptist Church in Papua says Papuans remain more disadvantaged than ever. Erica Vols reports.
Reverend Socrates Sofian Yeoman is the head of West Papua's Baptist Church.
Our experience after implemented spatial autonomy since 2001 is no change, no improving, especially the local people or West Papuans people. Human rights abuses still going on. Yeah, military operation is still going on. And also in West Papua, is in special autonomy era, is migrant is increasing rapidly. West Papua economically dominated by migrants.
Reverend Yeoman says the newly elected governor is too dominated by Jakarta's influence to help indigenous West Papuans. And he says it's the increasing numbers of predominantly Muslim migrants who flock to Papua from Java and other parts of Indonesia that are benefiting most from autonomy because they're capturing the most prestigious jobs and governmental positions. The spokesperson for the Indonesian Embassy in Australia, Dino Kusnadi, denies these claims.
Every year go out with a report that's similar to the same, claiming that the special autonomy doesn't work. Unfortunately, his claims is based on prejudice. It's also based on inaccurate data. If you look into the facts that the developments in Papua is actually more vigorous and also more positive in the last 2 years under the new governor of Papua.
Contradicting this view, the Indonesian army has recently increased troop levels in West Papua, and reports suggest many West Papuans have fled their villages. A resistance fighter told FSRN that Dontas Weptu, a 36-year-old man from a village in the Maluku province, was executed this month by Indonesian Special Army Forces, and local police have so far refused to investigate. Reverend Yeoman maintains real improvements in human rights conditions won't occur until West Papuan independence fighters, church leaders and human rights groups can sit down and negotiate a peace settlement with the central Indonesian government.
We need the model like Aceh's problem, Aceh problem, with an international community negotiate, facilitate, we sit together to solve the problem. But our question is, why Indonesian government never opened the way to dialogue?
This is Erica Vowles in Sydney, reporting for Free Speech Radio News.
Free Speech Radio News is a worker-run collective. Today's newscast was produced by Turna Gise and myself, Aaron Glantz, sitting in for Monica Lopez. Our headlines editor is Shannon Young. DC editor is Leanne Caldwell. Our technical production team at KPFA in Berkeley includes Eric Klein and Christina Anastad, who's sitting in for Antonio Ortiz. We podcast online at www.fsrn.org. That's www.fsrn.org. You can send your questions, comments, and story ideas to comments@fsrn.org. That's comments@fsrn.org. From KPFA in Berkeley, this is Aaron Glantz, sitting in for Aldo Bogado.